Chapter 26, If the Invader Comes. After what Molly had done, I wasn't going to pander to her by helping less in the house. I made sure I was occupied for every moment of every day. I also started going to bed early with a book. When I heard Molly coming upstairs, I would lie down and pretend to be asleep, so I didn't have to speak to her. I left the house earlier in the mornings, telling Auntie Rose I'd been made a classroom monitor and had duties before school. I still walked home with Molly and Frank, but only because I didn't want Frank to know anything was wrong. He would chat away about his day, and he didn't notice that I would just talk to him and never say a word to his sister. Molly was making a big effort to be nice, always approaching me cautiously, as though I was a mistreated dog who might attack at the slightest provocation. I ignored her as much as possible without making things obvious to the rest of the family. I avoided eye contact and only spoke to her when I absolutely had to. Everyone else at school was being extra chatty and friendly. My friends all apologised for taking any notice of Billy. Nancy even wrote a letter begging my forgiveness, and Margaret baked me a cake. It wasn't too hard to forgive them. They'd been friendly to me from the beginning, and they had resisted all Billy's nasty comments until the whole country became obsessed with spies and parachutists. But I could never, ever forgive Molly. Normally, Auntie Rose and Uncle Bert might have noticed something was wrong, but they had just been told that Lord and Lady Hurstwood were moving to Canada for the duration of the war, and their butler, Mr. Robbins, who was a friend of Uncle Bert's, had asked Uncle Bert and Auntie Rose to help the few remaining servants pack up the valuables and put the best furniture into storage. It was Mr. Robbins, I discovered, whom I'd mistaken for Lord Hurstwood when Molly and I had gone to Ashcombe House to ask for jobs for my parents. So the days passed, and outwardly things seemed much the same as before. And then, one morning in the middle of June, everything changed again. We had just finished breakfast when we heard a vehicle rumbling up the lane. Frank ran into the front room and looked out of the window. He turned to us, grinning, his cheeks flushed with excitement. "An army truck! Coming into the yard!" The truck drove across the yard and stopped right outside the cottage. The vehicle's doors opened and shut. Boots thudded on the ground. My stomach knotted. There was a sharp knock at the door. I felt sick. Every sight of a soldier, every knock on the door, still had that effect on me. Auntie Rose opened the door. Filling the little doorway stood an officer and a soldier, both in khaki battle dress. "Good morning, madam," said the officer. "I'm sorry to disturb you, but we need to see what spare accommodation you have." Auntie Rose laughed. "Chance would be a fine thing. We have 2 small bedrooms and 5 of us living here." "All the same, we have to look, if you don't mind," said the officer. "You'd better come in then." She stepped aside to let them enter. "My son sleeps in here," she said, showing them the little front room with Frank's bedding folded up on the sofa. The officer glanced inside and nodded. She led him up the steep staircase. "The girls sleep here," she said, and I heard the creak of our bedroom door, followed by the rattle of the latch on the other side of the tiny landing. "And this is our room," she said, "my husband and I." "I see," said the officer. "Well, you're right. There's no space to billet any soldiers. Thank you for your time, madam." Nobody said anything until the truck started up again and left the yard. Then Auntie Rose said, "I wonder what that was about." On the walk to school, everyone was talking about the soldiers. It seemed they were visiting every house in the village, looking for spare bedrooms. They didn't have much luck. Everybody with a spare room had already taken in evacuees or land girls. Rumours buzzed around school as to why the army was looking for accommodation. 2 days later, Molly and I were getting dressed when we heard the rumbling of engines. Molly ran to the window and gasped, "Army lorries and motorbikes! Oh my goodness! There's dozens of them!" I stood, frozen in terror. The Germans had come. Molly rushed downstairs. I looked out of the window, my heart pounding. A convoy of lorries with motorcycle outriders was making its way up the Chestnut Avenue towards Ashcombe House. It wasn't the German army. It was the British army. What were they doing? Had the Germans invaded in the night? I pulled the suitcase out from under my bed and packed the box of letters in it. Then I put my socks and shoes on as quickly as I could. The back door opened. Had they come for me? I picked up my case and was about to sprint down the stairs when Uncle Bert stopped me in my tracks. so it wasn't the Nazis. Not yet. Just Uncle Bert, returning from his night shift with the local defence volunteers. I shoved the case back under the bed and walked downstairs, trying to look normal. Did you know about this? Auntie Rose was asking as I walked into the kitchen. Uncle Bert laid his shotgun, tin hat and gas mask on the table. He looked tired, but his blue eyes were sparkling. I just heard, and then I got almost crushed by their blooming great convoy. The army's taking over the whole park. Everyone with a spare room's having troops billeted on them, and the rest will be living in the big house. Frank gasped with excitement. Soldiers everywhere! Do you think they'll let me ride in their tanks? They haven't got tanks, said Uncle Bert. Not yet, at least. Trucks everywhere, though, and lorries and motorbikes. When we walked home from school that day, it was as though we were living in a different place. The entire park had been transformed into an army camp. Everywhere there were soldiers, some being drilled, some exercising in vests and shorts, some servicing the vehicles that were parked all along the Chestnut Avenue and on the gravel in front of the main entrance. They said hello to us as we passed. Molly and Frank replied cheerily, Frank practically bouncing with excitement. I tried to control my choking panic so I could say hello too, but my throat was too tight to speak. The next day, Miss Marshall wasn't at her desk when we came in for afternoon lessons. She arrived 5 minutes late, which she had never done before. She was very pale and her expression was strained. It was clear she had something to say. We waited in silence. I'm very sorry to have to tell you, children, she said, taking a deep breath, that France has surrendered to Germany. My body turned to ice. There was nothing left. Nothing but the English Channel between us and Hitler. The troops at Ashcombe Park, we learned, were stationed there as part of Britain's defences. The Germans were expected to invade the south coast at any moment. Everywhere, tank traps and pillboxes started to appear. All the beaches were mined and covered with barbed wire to repel invading troops. The government sent a leaflet to every household called If the Invader Comes, with lots of instructions about staying in your home and not panicking. Auntie Rose was not impressed. Honestly, she said, flinging the leaflet on the kitchen table. Men! It's all very well telling everyone to refuse to give water or food to German troops, but what do they imagine a Nazi soldier's going to do if I try to stop him coming into my kitchen? And how is it going to help the war effort if my children end up motherless? Uncle Bert jerked his thumb towards the cupboard by the kitchen stove, where his shotgun was locked up. If you see or hear anything suspicious when I'm not around, Rosie, you get that gun out, all right? I'll keep it loaded and ready, and you know where the key is. I knew where the key was too, but I had no idea how soon I would need that knowledge.